Welcome to the Earth First Update, bringing you all the environmental news you can use for over 20 years. I'm Uncle Dennis here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org on Thursday, the 7th of September, 2017. I want to ask you to have a pencil and paper handy so you can write down names, addresses, email, web pages, and phone numbers so you can take action for the environment. And let's start with announcements. The Buffalo Field Campaign Roadshow will be getting underway next week. Buffalo Field Campaign's co-founder and campaign coordinator Mike Meese is hitting the road again in September and October for his annual Buffalo Field Campaign Roadshow, and he could use your help. As he has done since 1999, Mike will be visiting communities in Washington, Oregon, and California to share music, stories, video, and discussion, all of which is inspired by The Last Wild Bison. Mike will be joined by musician Mignon Gelly for these very special events. Please check out their calendar of events or the 2017 Roadshow events on their website for locations and join our veteran Buffalo Defenders for an inspiring time. Would you like to help out at a roadshow? Here's some ideas. You could host the show, offer up your home, or find a friendly local place willing to donate the space. Volunteer at the show. You could help welcome and sign in guests, provide or help serve food and drinks, and help with the setup, breakdown, cleanup, or any of the other jobs it takes to put on a roadshow. And you can help promote one or more shows. Post event information on your web page, Facebook, or other social media. Invite your friends and family and notify local media of the Buffalo Field Campaign's visit to your area. You can email Mike Meese at Meese, M-E-A-S-E, at buffalofieldcampaign.org. That's M-E-A-S-E at buffalofieldcampaign.org. Or you could call the office and ask for Mike. Area code 406-646-0070. That number again, 406-646-0070. And here in California, endangered species protections are being sought for the Cascades frog. The Center for Biological Diversity has petitioned the California Fish and Game Commission to list the Cascades frog as an endangered species under the State Endangered Species Act. Cascade frogs have been lost from most of their former habitats in the mountain lakes and streams of Northern California, primarily due to disease and the introduction of non-native fish. 40 years ago, you could still find the Cascades frog across much of Northern California. Today, it has disappeared from most of its range, and it's still losing ground, said Jeff Miller, conservation advocate with the Center for Biological Diversity. The good news is that we can still save Cascade frogs with the critical protection of the California Endangered Species Act. Cascades frogs once lived in the Shasta-Trinity region of the Modoc Plateau, over to the Modoc Plateau and south through Lassen National Parks to the Upper Feather River. Remaining populations are in the Klamath Trinity region, the Southern Cascades in the vicinity of Mount Shasta, and in the Lassen area. The introduction of non-native trout to formerly fishless lakes is a major threat to Cascade frogs since the fish predate upon and compete with frogs for food. Cascade frogs are also susceptible to a particularly virulent fungal pathogen, which causes the disease citridomycosis in amphibians. Other threats include pesticides, climate change, fire suppression, livestock grazing, and habitat loss from vegetation management, and the ever-present timber harvest. A recent study warned that amphibians are suffering an unprecedented extinction crisis, with 200 frog species around the world wiped out since the 1970s, and hundreds more frogs species are at risk. Our world would be a much less interesting place without frogs, Mr. Miller said. California should do everything it can to keep Cascade frogs around. And from Bite Back magazine, we read from Italy, during the night of September 2nd and 3rd, windows were broken and furniture destroyed at a hunting club in Prevalle, that's in Brescia, Italy. In addition, cages were opening, freeing 200 quail and partridges that were set to be hunted. And the Mi'kmaq territory, the river camp is here to stay in this story from It's Going Down. Yesterday's torrential downpour forced us to have a slow evening. Lit by the glow of candles and lulled by the drip of raindrops on tarps, some of us played Scrabble while others read out loud. Today, despite the constant drizzle, the mood remains energetic at the river camp. We have learned that Junex will suspend work for over 4 months, providing time for the MMS as well as the band councils of Gespec, Gespegiag, and Lusteodju to hold public consultations for the residents of these three reserves to give input on fossil fuel development projects under and on unceded Mi'kmaq territory. 3 weeks ago, an anonymous blockade of the access route to the Galt sites considerably destabilized the oil company, which until this point had been operating under the radar as much as possible, not even having held a preliminary public consultation on their project. We want to underscore the fact that this new development, which was announced yesterday by the band councils, would probably never have happened without the enormous efforts of the many people struggling on the ground, those who were active during the blockade, the indigenous people and the settlers who have been working together at the river camp, as well as the environmental groups have been struggling for years in the Gaspésie. The river camp is active, alive, and here to stay. The temporary halt of Junex's work is no guarantee that the work will stop forever, nor does it signal the end of fossil fuel exploitation in the territory. Thus, we are determined to pursue this struggle. The river camp is a place for organizing, sharing information, and exchanging ideas. The need for such spaces which inspire and make waves far beyond the limits of the camp as such remain essential. We want an active public conversation, one that takes place horizontally, and it is this that we will continue to nurture. The strength of the relationships created or maintained by the camp is significant. In this perspective, we reaffirm our call for a week of actions, which started with a demonstration on Gaspé on the 4th of September. You could pass by the camp at the river at any time, whether for a brief stay, to walk around the fire, or to have a long-term involvement. We also had a banner-making and circus workshop, as well as a poetry slam on September 2nd. The last rays of summer sunshine are giving way to the coolness of autumn, and we are still here, enthusiastic and determined. And the Panama trial of three Ngabe workers, a pattern of intimidation and criminalization in this story by Tracy Barnett for Intercontinental Cry. Manolo Miranda, leader of the indigenous community recently flooded by the Barro Blanco Dam, now faces up to 2 years in prison for causing delays and financial losses to the company that has ruined his community's way of life. Miranda is scheduled for trial on August 18th, together with two other leaders of the Ngabe Bugle who oppose the dam, Regional Sique Toribo Garcia, and religious and protest leader Clementina Perez. All three face up to 2 years in prison for trespassing and interfering with the inviability of work for their alleged role in an encampment that blocked the entrance of the hydro dam in May and June of 2015. Charges against two other activists who were present at the encampment, Oscar Sogandares and Carmen Tedman, have been provisionally dismissed. Human rights and environmental leaders say the case is typical of a growing trend of using the courts to silence and intimidate environmental and human rights defenders throughout the country. Some point to a request made in March of this year by the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights in Washington, D.C., to meet with such defenders and try to address the problem. Miranda's sister, Winnie Bagama, was one of those who testified at the IACHR hearing in March, and Barro Blanco was one of the cases dismissed. Government representatives have not responded to requests for information on the process or on the lawsuit. It's very worrisome because this is not an isolated case, said Susanna Saracine of the Alliance for Conservation and Development, one of the organizations that worked over the years to halt the dam. We are seeing a pattern of intimidation and harassment, and we are not seeing any support on the part of the government. Neither the Ministry of Foreign Affairs or Defensoria responded to Intercontinental's cries for questions despite repeated email. It's a very serious problem, said Dr. Donaldo Souza, president of the Panamanian Association of Environmental Law and a law professor at the University of Panama. Environmental crimes are being committed on a daily basis in Panama, he said, with activists denouncing them in good faith. He has filed more than 70 lawsuits in the past 8 years. The great majority have not been prosecuted, he said. Instead, the courts are going after the human rights defenders and the ecologists. As Mugabe leaders prepared for their trial, word came of another lawsuit against a development opponent in Panama City, in which his belongings were seized as part of the investigation. Max Crowell, president of the Homeowners Association of Ciudad Jardín El Brook, won a lawsuit halting construction of a private school due to irregularities affecting the neighborhood. The company retaliated by suing Crowell. His home was searched and items were seized in the investigation. Other cases of environmentalists being sued included Larissa Duarte of the Campesino Movement for the Rio Cobre de Veraguas, sued for $10 million for stopping a hydroelectric dam on that river. Community leaders in Coco del Mar, a neighborhood that fought the destruction of a mangrove forest to make way for construction of a high-rise apartment city in Panama City. Forestry expert Basilio Perez in the region of Azuero, sued for $40,000 by the mining company Cerro Quema, also for financial losses following a lawsuit against the company for environmental violations. Sousa told Intercontinental Cry that there are additional cases where environmentalists are being physically threatened, sometimes with death, as in the case of journalist Ligia Arrega, who was forced to flee Panama last year for defense of the country's largest wetlands, Mata Sagrati. In June of this year, two owners of the company were sentenced to 2 years in jail for environmental crimes against the wetlands. Nonetheless, those who made attempts on Arega's life remain at large, and there is apparently no effort to prosecute. In the Barro Blanco case, Sousa filed a lawsuit before the dam was built against the individuals who carried out the environmental impact study, as well as the Public Services Agency Director Roberto Miana and former Minister of the Environment Mere Endara. The complaint charged that fundamental data regarding damage to the area's ecological heritage, environment, and quality of life for the communities was false or missing. The result of that complaint was that nothing was done. It was not investigated at that time, said Sousa. Here in Panama, there is too much impunity on the part of those who investigate the crimes. Francia Archibald, the attorney who is representing the three Mugabe leaders, told that there is no doubt in her mind that they should be acquitted completely. For one thing, she said the three leaders are among more than 100 people, and it was unfair for them to be singled out. Practically, the entire community was there, and they were sincerely fighting for their rights, she said. I, as an attorney, can indisputably say that there is a certain level of persecution here. The reason is to harass the leaders with the sole purpose of silencing them, because they definitely have the power to convoke the people. Meanwhile, in the community of Clad, Miranda and other Mugabe residents are living with the consequences of the illegal flooding of the Barro Blanco Dam. The waters of their sacred Tabascara River, which they once fished and bathed in, has grown into a stagnant lake, killing the fish, swallowing the food forest that was their sustenance, and flooding the sacred petroglyphs that connected them to their ancestors. Some residents' homes have been destroyed, leaving them homeless. Contacted by telephone, Miranda said the waters have risen to just within a few meters of his home and the cultural center and school for the Mugabe language at the heart of the community. His sister, Mugabe congressional delegate Winnie Bagama, shared an interview with Intercontinental Cry in a June visit to Panama City and described the conditions in the community. We used to live very peacefully. We slept with our children happily all night, and after they flooded us, we have no peace, she said. Now, from 6 p.m. onward, huge quantities of mosquitoes descend upon us. We do not have the repellents or mosquito nets because it is an expense that we can't possibly cover, and anyway, it's something we never needed before. Fever and diarrhea have also increased in the community, and children are being covered with mosquito bites, which are leading to infections, Bagama said. In addition, there is not enough food to go around since the community's cropland was flooded. Before, we had a wide range of fruits from a productive multi-generational food forest along the river. Now we are living on the little bit that people can bring from neighboring communities, the little that they can buy and whatever they can grow in other areas higher up, but the production has been very limited. We do not want to be a burden on anybody. We want them to lower the reservoir because the food we had, the territory to produce we had, she said. We caught shrimp and fish in that river, and now we cannot do any of that. Both Bagama and Miranda told Intercontinental Cry that the government sent representatives to the community in March and offered them compensation for the land. Their position and that of the movement they represent against the dam, the Movimiento 10 de Abril, is that they are not willing to accept compensation for their land. They offered us a pittance, giving us food for a day and taking away our lands that have offered us economic, food, social, and cultural security for over 500 years, said Miranda. We cannot share that policy with the government in any way. Meanwhile, the lawsuit has taken its toll in terms of peace of mind for Miranda and his neighbors. We feel a great social and legal insecurity. I feel as if there is no guarantee to my right and the right of the people. I feel deprived of my free expression, said Miranda. We have lost part of our land and our crops. And this dysfunctional wildfire funding model all but ensures that more public lands will burn. In this story from the Teddy Roosevelt Conservation Partnership, the need for a fire borrowing fix grows as the West burns. With elk and other deer seasons right around the corner, I've been running, biking, and hiking as often as I can on the public lands near TRCP's western office in Missoula, Montana. You'd think that my main challenge would be climbing a particularly steep mountain trail, but lately the real hurdle has been simply trying to breathe. The smell of smoke from the many active wildfires in western Montana clings to my clothing long after I've returned to my desk. To make matters worse, many of our neighboring public and private lands have been evacuated and remain closed because of the wildfires bearing down on our community. At worst, these wildfires are terrifying. At best, they're a major inconvenience for those of us who are living for fall. When the rains finally come and the smoke clears, we'll look back at 2017 as being a nasty fire year in Montana and all other areas of the West. It should also be a year when Congress finally fixes the wildfire funding crisis that has made it difficult for the U.S. Forest Service to do its job and has left our public lands even more susceptible to fire. It's a cycle that's fanning the flames. Like all federal agencies, the Forest Service has an annual budget. It's meant to underwrite maintenance of roads, trails, and campgrounds, and the active management of our forests, projects like thinning trees and improving habitat through prescribed burns and other tactics. They also depend on that budget to pay for firefighting on public lands. The problem is that wildfire seasons are getting longer and more intense in the West, and when wildfire season is particularly intense, the Forest Service is required to pull money from other accounts to pay for fire suppression. When this happens, forest management and maintenance projects get put on hold, making it difficult, if not impossible, for the agency to do its job. Since 2002, this cycle has been an ongoing issue for the Forest Service. In turn, other land management programs have been neglected, resulting in unsatisfactory national forest management and increased frustration all around. To put the current budget crisis in perspective, wildlife suppression made up 16% of the Forest Service's budget in 1995. By 2015, wildfires cost the agency 50% of its budget for the whole year. According to the Forest Service, if left unchecked, the share of the budget devoted to fire in 2025 could exceed two-thirds of the budget, further exacerbating the problem. Without a fix for fire borrowing, there's no doubt that the shortfall in funding will continue to fail us, leaving our forests vulnerable, poorly managed, or completely toasted. Fortunately, two widely supported bipartisan solutions are on the table, both of which would take steps to ensure that the most extreme wildfires would be granted suppression funding from the Disaster Relief Fund, the pool of money that is used in case of catastrophic weather events like floods, earthquakes, and hurricanes. In other words, the proposed legislation would ensure that large, dangerous, and expensive forest fires are treated like all other weather-related natural disasters, which seems like common sense. The first bill is the Wildfire Disaster Funding Act, which has strong support in Congress and from a diverse coalition of interests, ranging from sportsmen to the timber industry and in the environmental community. A second bipartisan solution has been proposed by Senator Michael Crapo and Sherrod Brown. The newest National Flood Insurance Program Reauthorization Act includes a provision that would prohibit transferring money away from non-fire programs and at the same time establishes a new source of funding for wildfire suppression through the disaster relief funds. Either these much-needed fixes directly addresses the continued erosion of agency budgets from our increased cost of wildfire fighting. This is the support we need for thoughtful, active management of our public lands, especially right now. It is concerning that Congress has been unable to find a funding fix across the finish line in the last several years. It seems that the problem is forgotten as soon as fire season ends, but out of sight, out of mind conservation won't take us far in maintaining the public lands that legacy that Theodore Roosevelt helped create and that make our country so unique. My hope is that this year's smoky summer will linger in lawmakers' minds as much as the scent of it lingers on my pack, but it's up to sportsmen and women to convince our elected officials that it's time to extinguish the problem once and for all. With more than 75 active fires burning nearly a million acres across the U.S. right now, these solutions couldn't come at a more pivotal time. And a new study shows that lesser prairie chicken decline continues in this story from the Center for Biological Diversity. A new study released by the U.S. Geological Survey has found that lesser prairie chickens, rare grasslands, dancing birds continue to decline and will be threatened with extinction as climate change worsens and more habitat is lost. The study is part of a review of the species for protection under the Endangered Species Act. The USGS study is the first to incorporate the effects of global warming on lesser prairie chicken survival. The bird has already declined to just 1% of its historic abundance, living in isolated grasslands in eastern New Mexico, southeastern Colorado, Kansas, and Oklahoma, and the Texas Panhandle. The study's authors found that incorporating higher temperatures and lower precipitation into future models for this species of grouse shows lower survival rates and, in some populations, near-term extinction. This is a blinking red light on the dashboard that warning us emergency action is needed to save these birds, Michael Robinson, a conservation advocate at the Center for Biological Diversity. Prairie chickens should be granted endangered species protection immediately. Lesser prairie chickens are celebrated for their unique, colorful springtime courtship rituals, but habitat destruction has eliminated almost all the birds and confined the survivors to tiny portions of their original habitat. To try and head off Endangered Species Act protections for the bird, the five states where they live created a range-wide plan for conserving the prairie chicken. But in 2014, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service acknowledged that the voluntary plan failed to reduce threats to the lesser prairie chicken and placed it on the threatened species list. The following year, however, through litigation, oil and gas interests and counties in New Mexico induced the service to delist the prairie chicken and to reconsider the voluntary plan. Yet despite the voluntary plan, habitat destruction continues apace, isolating the birds in smaller populations as their numbers continue to drop. Global warming will make that worse, suggesting that threatened status is no longer sufficient and endangered would be a more apt classification. Scientists have now made clear that we'll have to pull out all the stops to save the lesser prairie chicken from extinction, said Mr. Robinson. It's time to use the Endangered Species Act to halt the habitat loss for this beautiful bird and pass time to dramatically reduce the emissions that are cooking us and the prairie chicken alike. For more information, go to www.biologicaldiversity.org. And ranchers and politics are killing Oregon's endangered wolves in this story from Eric Mulvar of The Hill. As wolves are recolonizing the wide-open spaces of the West, they are running into a buzzsaw of political meddling at the hands of the ranching industry that yearns for the glory days of its forebears who wantonly killed wolves to the brink of extinction generations ago. In eastern Oregon, public controversy has erupted over a kill order issued this month by state wildlife officials for two members of the Harl Butte Wolf Pack in northeastern Oregon, the latest in a long and bloody history of political deals, deception, and feuding over the ranching industry's perceived right to kill native wildlife to ease its mind and further its profits. Unlike many western states, Oregon has its own unique Endangered Species Act, adopted in 1984 to protect wildlife rare or imperiled in the state. Wolves immediately became an endangered species when the law was adopted, and it wasn't very controversial because the species was completely extinct in the state at that time. As the gray wolf began its comeback in the inland Northwest, however, the situation quickly got out of hand. In 2005, Oregon adopted a state wolf plan. As usual in collaborative processes, commercial interests got their wish list, including the ability to have wolves killed if they could be linked to predation on domestic livestock. And so the state adopted a plan allowing an endangered species to be killed in violation of Oregon state law. And so when the first wolves made it into Oregon through natural dispersal, the first pack, the Inmaha tract, was subjected to multiple killings at the request of ranchers. In 2011, the dwindling pack was targeted with a kill order for two of the four remaining pack members, including one of the alpha pair. Cascadia Wildlands, an Oregon environmental group, immediately filed for a court injunction to block the kill order. Nick Cady, an attorney with Cascadia Wildlands, succeeded in having a judge block the Imnaha Pack's kill order the same day. Thanks to these protections, one of the Imnaha Pack's offspring, OR7, established the first-ever breeding pack of wolves in southwestern Oregon and later became grandsire to California's new Lassen Pack. Wolves are listed under California's Endangered Species Act and enjoy strong protections because California's state law prohibits the killing of wolves for the benefit of agricultural operations or any other reason. Of course, this scientifically questionable wolf delisting was immediately challenged in court, and the lawsuit is currently pending. When outgoing Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber left under a cloud of ethics allegations in 2015, Secretary of State Kate Brown became governor. She inherited Kitzhaber's staff on natural resources issues, who happened to be quite cozy with the Eastern Oregon livestock industry. In the midst of the chaos, the Cattlemen's Association pushed through a bill, House Bill 4040, declaring an emergency and blocking the courts from ruling on state endangered species decisions, including wolves. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 p.m. right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org. You can hear a rebroadcast tomorrow afternoon during Environment Friday at 3 p.m. You could also tune to WMNB 107.1 in North Adams, Massachusetts, Fridays at 5:30 a.m., KRFP 90.3 in Moscow, Idaho, Wednesdays at 3 p.m., KOWA 106.5 in Olympia, Washington, Saturdays at 7 a.m., WLSL 92.7 in Dade City, Florida, Sundays at noon, KHCF 89.9 in Morgan Hill, Gilroy, California, KGIG 104.9 in Modesto, California, KPHD 93.3 in Modesto, California, and Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1 in Berkeley, California, all rebroadcast the Earth First Update. Go to their websites for time and date. You could also tune on the internet to Grateful Dread Public Radio, gdprnashville.org. That's gdprnashville.org, Sundays at 2 a.m. Or you could always listen to radioforall.net. That's where you can listen online or download this or any previous Earth First Update. That webpage again, radioforall.net, and that's the number 4. Please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and to broadcast. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and produced at the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening, and please do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.